Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and I'm broadcasting once again from Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming as the National Park Service this week celebrates its 100th birthday. And Meghna, as you can tell, there is a little bit of a delay on our connection. I want to talk about that for a minute because it's pretty unique what we're doing here. We're sitting on a porch at the Old Faithful Inn, which is more than 100 years old, and there's basically no internet here. There's no Wi-Fi, so we couldn't connect like we ordinarily would when we go on the road. We're also sitting on top of a volcano at around 7,300 feet. They tell us that TV satellite trucks never really work very well here. So we are connected to you using a device called a Comrex, and it's connected through an old-fashioned phone line. There's literally a phone cable draped along this porch that we're sitting on right now. So if at any point in the show people wonder, well, why does this sound so different? Why does Jeremy sound so different than he usually does? Just know that we are doing something that really has never been done before, and we're in the middle of a national park in a place where technology just does not work the way it does back home, especially, Meghna, when all the tourists who are watching Old Faithful, which is steaming right in front of us right now, decide to upload their videos at the same time.
Well, Jeremy, about 1,800 miles to the southeast of you, President Obama is in southern Louisiana today to witness the damage of days of flooding surrounding Baton Rouge. Some are criticizing the president for not cutting his vacation short to head to the devastated region sooner. More than 100,000 people in the area have now registered for federal disaster aid. And joining us with more is NPR's Kirk Sigler. He's been covering the story in Louisiana. Kirk, you're outside in Lafayette, west of Baton Rouge. Give us a picture of what things are like on the ground right now.
Well, I'm in a neighborhood that is still underwater more than a week later. I'm looking at an abandoned gas station, a mechanic shop across the street that's got about a couple feet of water. I just talked to a gentleman here who's lived here since 1959. His house is still got standing water in it. He's about to walk back in and check in on things. This just sort of speaks to just the sheer scale of this disaster. I drove about 100 miles to get here across some of the worst hit areas. In Baton Rouge, which is justifiably getting a lot of the attention, you know, the water has for the most part receded and people are trying to clean out and gut out homes and salvage what they can. But I think it's telling that when you get all the way over here to Lafayette and other places, I'm told, south of here, you know, it's still a flooding situation. It's still an active flooding situation. And each afternoon, there have been more warnings for more floods.
Huh. Now, do we have a sense as to the scale of the damage? I mean, I'm hearing you talk about how far-reaching the actual flooding has been. I'm presuming the damage has been great as well.
Exactly, and it keeps going up, which you might expect in a slow-to-unfold disaster like this. You know, until recently, some highways were cut off, some roads were cut off, and people couldn't even get in to figure out what the assessment of damage is. So we are seeing the destruction toll go up in the tens of thousands, and tens of thousands of more people have applied for aid, federal, state, and otherwise. And I wouldn't be surprised if it continues to go up as we get across the state and really get a sense for the scale of this.
And you're standing there next to at least one busy highway. We can hear that is functioning. But has the response around various flooded areas been equal, or have certain people been disproportionately affected in this flood and the recovery process?
You know, that depends on who you ask and who you talk to. I was at a shelter here in Lafayette, and there are still, you know, 100 or so people still living in the shelter. There are a lot of low-income people in and around this area who don't have wide safety nets. As you might imagine, they don't have a lot of money to deal with a crisis like this and don't have a lot of options while they wait for aid to come in. Some of the more rural areas, the aid has been slow to get to, as I said, because it's been cut off. And it had been more than a week it took for the state to open up a disaster center for people to come in and apply for food stamp assistance at one place I visited. So it kind of just depends on where you are. But as you can imagine, natural disasters, of course, hit some people worse than others.
Right. I mean, and so many people, of course, are thinking about lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina, which is more than a decade ago now. I mean, does it seem to you as if lessons have been learned both at the state and federal level in terms of how to get aid to people as fast as possible?
I hate to punt, but I'd have to say that also depends on who you ask. There are a lot of comparisons being drawn to Hurricane Katrina, but, you know, this one's different. In particular, some of the attention being drawn from it from outside, I think it's been a lot of folks here on the ground are telling me anyway that they feel like it hasn't gotten some of the attention that it deserves, and that may be because some people are still just figuring out the scope of things, and some people until recently were cut off. I think there has been some criticism here on the ground about whether or not some of the infrastructure really was improved and whether there were lessons learned from Katrina or not. But as in any still unfolding situation, I think it's hard to make direct comparisons at this time.
Well, NPR's Kirk Siegler is reporting to us today from Lafayette, Louisiana. Kirk, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In this week's Senate Tracker, we're taking a look at Alaska's Senate race. It pits incumbent Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski against two challengers, a Democrat and an independent. Liz Ruskin is Washington correspondent with Alaska Public Radio. And Liz, first, let's go back in time a bit. Senator Murkowski has been in office since 2002, but her career has had some interesting twists and turns. So remind us what happened in her last Senate race in 2010.
In 2010, Murkowski lost her primary election to a Tea Party candidate named Joe Miller. And that was a bit of a surprise since she was our incumbent senator. And he came at her from the right and beat her in the primary.
Beat her in the primary, but then she went on to win the general election as a write-in candidate.
As a write-in. And it's a little hard to write in when your name is Murkowski. It's not as easy as Jones. She printed up these rubber armbands with her name on it so that voters would know how to spell it. And I believe she was the second senator to ever win a general by a write-in.
Oh, yes. So that was 2010. Here we are 6 years later, and Senator Murkowski is running for re-election again. But this time around, she won her primary with 72% of the vote. So a ringing endorsement from Alaska Republicans. So what's different for her this year?
Well, this year she was prepared for a primary challenge. She was prepared for a challenge on the right. She started raising money very early. I believe she has about $6 or $7 million now. And she had no name brand challengers on the Republican side.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of one of the ads that Senator Murkowski is running.
From the oil patch to the job site, Alaska's energy means Alaskan jobs. That's why I'm taking on the Obama administration and the EPA, fighting back against federal overreach to expand energy production, create more Alaskan jobs, and increase America's energy security.
So in that clip, Senator Murkowski obviously setting herself up in opposition to the Obama administration, not an uncommon thing amongst Republicans in this election cycle. But Liz, I understand that in some cases, the senator has actually been known to reach out and work with Democrats. So how has that gone over with Alaska voters?
That sort of thing plays well, that she works with Democrats to actually pass legislation. What doesn't play well is abortion. She's generally pro-choice. She tries to stand in a middle ground on abortion, and she's disappointed both sides in the abortion debate quite a few times.
Mm. Well, let's take a look at some of her rivals in the general election here. On the Democratic side, Ray Metcalf. Now, he's been in a lot of past races in Alaska and has actually run as a Republican at other times. Does he have any chance this time around?
He doesn't have a lot of clear support, and his primary was he didn't raise enough money to require him to file with the FEC, so he's running a non-monetary campaign so far. Maybe it'll be different in the general.
A non-monetary campaign. That's a very good way of putting it. There is an independent in this race as well, Margaret Stock. We've got one of her online ads here, a little bit of it. And in the ad, there are two sets of people who are playing a game of tug of war. course, meant to represent partisanship in Congress. And then Margaret Stock uses a chainsaw to cut right through the rope. Here's the ad.
We need an independent from the last frontier to cut through the partisan gridlock. Congress is broken. Let's fix it and get this country moving again.
Love the sound of the chainsaw.
Oh, you got to have the chainsaw. Also, she really was operating that chainsaw. I checked. I did a hand matchup.
Very Alaska.
Right. It would just not do to fake anything regarding a chainsaw.
No. Now, how much does this message appeal to voters in the state?
Well, she's pro-choice, and that's a big deal for some Alaskans. She also is anti-Trump. She's denounced Lisa Murkowski for not coming out against Trump. And the other thing she really has going for her is that she's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserves. Alaska is a big military state, and it has the highest number of veterans per capita. So I think that does play well with some Republicans who are unhappy with Lisa Murkowski.
Mm-hmm. Well, Liz Ruskin is Washington correspondent with Alaska Public Radio, bringing us up to speed with the latest on the Senate race. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Yellowstone National Park as the National Park Service turns 100 years old this week. And where we are in the park is a place that is surrounded by geysers, and not just the most famous one, Old Faithful, which erupts every 90 minutes or so. There are many others. And to learn more about these geysers, we are joined right now by Dr. Bob Smith, a geologist from the University of Utah, who has been studying these geysers for how many years now?
I've been here for 59 years of my research career.
59 years. And Rebecca Rowland is here as well, a park ranger here at Yellowstone. And you've been here for how long, Rebecca?
Since 2000.
Okay, so we need to start off with the fact that the reason that we've got all these geysers in this area that are erupting all the time is because we're sitting on top of a supervolcano.
Yeah, Yellowstone National Park, what most people don't realize, is actually an active volcano, and it sits on top of a globally significant hotspot, which means it derives its magma from deep in the Earth's core plume area into two shallow magma bodies that are beneath Yellowstone today. And the hot fluids and the heat that is derived from the shallowest magma body at a depth of here, about only 3 or 4 miles, is what drives Yellowstone's geysers.
Rebecca, are they connected to each other? When one geyser goes off, does it have anything to do with the geyser next door?
Well, that depends where you are in the park. Up here on Geyser Hill, where we are now, yes, there's some interconnectivity that goes on. So you've got geysers stealing heat and energy from each other. And then, so it makes it harder to predict when they'll erupt. Old Faithful is all on its own. So there's not a whole lot of other geysers connected to it. It's very predictable. The recharge rate in the large chamber where it gets its water from, its source, is very predictable too because of its isolation.
How do we know when Old Faithful is going to erupt? There's even an app now that tells you when it's going to go.
There is an app. I have it on my phone. We actually enter the times into the app, but it just comes from years and years of observation. And over the years, Old Faithful's intervals have actually lengthened.
By a lot or how much?
By quite a bit. They've gone from 65, 68 minutes to about 94 minutes that we're using now.
And Bob, what does that tell you about what's going to happen in the future with Old Faithful? Or does it tell you anything about what's going to happen in the future?
Well, in terms of future, it's a predictor perhaps of Old Faithful, but not of the other geyser features or the whole volcanic system. As I said, the geysers are just the end product of this whole plumbing system. So the fact that Old Faithful has a longer eruption cycle may have something to do with the total heat flux being less. That system is probably receiving fluids from the surrounding meteoric waters. If those waters go down or up in volume, you're going to change the amount of pressure in the hot water kettle itself.
Of all the things that we know about Old Faithful, you've just discovered something that we never knew about Old Faithful after all these years by putting sensors around Old Faithful.
Yes, in November of 2015, we put 140 seismographs surrounding the upper geyser basin in Old Faithful, and we recorded the data continuously for 2 full weeks. And what we discovered were 2 primary things. is number one, Old Faithful itself, when it erupts, doesn't really has a very, very weak to no seismic signal. But prior to the eruption, 20 to 30 minutes, we get a large source of bubbling, boiling energy. And we thought the source of that energy would have been right below the geyser. That's what the cartoon says, but it is not. Hmm. The sources of it tend to be about a few tens of almost 100 meters west at a depth of only a few tens of meters. But I want to make people clear, these chambers that people think about the fluids, it's like a sponge. The rock is really very highly porous, and so the water can get hot, but the surrounding rocks are solid, plastic and hot. But it's not this vision of a tea kettle sitting on a pot. Hmm. It's just this hot sponge that's heating up.
I want to ask you this question as a park ranger, because I'm sure people do ask you this question. Is it dangerous to touch the water in the geyser?
It depends where. If you are walking by a geyser and water jets out the side of a vent and gets you on your leg, it's going to burn you very badly. Hmm. If it goes up in the air, you get tiny little droplets of water with a huge surface area. It cools quickly, so it'll actually come down as cold water.
Dr. Bob Smith, how many places on Earth are there that are like this?
Well, there are volcanic hotspots spread throughout the world, primarily in oceans and mid-oceanic ridges. The most popular ones are Hawaii and Iceland. Mm. There's another 20 or 30 hotspots around the world. Yellowstone is the only hotspot of this size that's within a continent. And so as a result of being in a continent, it's very accessible and has allowed us to be able to put arrays of literally hundreds and hundreds of seismographs on the ground to create these three-dimensional images of the structure with depth. 2 million years of active volcanism has created this whole system.
And when you say this whole system, there's a lot of really interesting wildlife in Yellowstone. Does that have to do with the fact that all these geysers are here, or how does it impact the rest of the ecosystem?
Well, I wrote a paper called The Yellowstone Geo-Ecosystem, and there we actually correlated the distribution of volcanic rocks and soils with other kinds of vegetation. And we found out that the greatest correlation for animal habitation, for feeding and living, correlates with the volcanic soils and the volcanic rocks rather than other types of background vegetation. And we think it's probably because the chemistry has changed just enough in the soils, it makes it perhaps a little bit more fertile. It's not because it's not high temperature, but there is, in fact, a one-to-one correlation. And therefore, we changed the name of the Yellowstone ecosystem to the Yellowstone geo-ecosystem.
Hmm. Rebecca, as we've been talking about the volcano, what do we know about when that's going to erupt next? I even saw an article that said it was going to go this year, but I don't know how they would know that.
You know, they always say that. You see that every couple of years, maybe it's a 7-year cycle, I don't know. They talk about how the volcano is going to erupt. It's going to be a cataclysmic affair.
I saw that it would wipe out the agriculture in the Midwest. It would cover Los Angeles.
When actually, I mean, a lot of Bob's work and a lot of other scientists' work shows that it really didn't affect sort of the eastern half of the U.S. I mean, it had a huge ash cloud that went out and covered most of the western United States.
This was hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Hundreds of thousands of years. The last eruption of the Yellowstone volcano was 640,000 years ago.
Huh.
And that was a caldera-forming eruption. And what most likely would happen isn't a caldera-forming eruption now. I mean, as Bob says, you go through volcanic cycles. The geysers, the hot springs, those are evidence of the heat underneath us and the end of a volcanic cycle. So what most likely would happen might be something like a hydrothermal explosion rather than an eruption.
What is that?
Hydrothermal explosion is when that steam and that pressure build underneath usually a thermal feature that's already existing. The one we have here is over in Biscuit Basin. It's called Black Diamond and Walpole. They've kind of joined together into one. And several times over the last about 15 years, it's built up, the pressure is built up, and all of a sudden you get huge steam bubbles forming and pushing up on the earth, and it just blows. Hmm. It's very violent. The last time that pool erupted, I think Bob was there in 2009, and it was about 75 feet high.
It was, and it was 20 feet behind my back.
Yeah.
Wow.
It had not erupted for 10 years, and I was standing there lecturing how rare earthquakes and volcanoes were, and my colleague was lecturing how rare volcanic or hydrothermal eruptions, and it went off literally 20 feet from me.
Wow.
And blew rocks out of the ground. They're up to 6 inches in diameter. Now, we've had, since the last eruption, super eruption, we've had 80 small eruptions, like the size of Mount St. Helens, Pinatubo in the Philippines, which are large, which kill people. But there, we've had 80 or so in the whole Yellowstone region. But we only have two inter-event times between the first super eruption, the second super eruption, and the second and the third. And that average interval is 700,000 years. And so people will say, well, from 640,000 years to 700,000 years, we got another 70,000 years to go. But let me stop right there. How many people in your audience have ever bought stock on the stock market on the basis of two numbers, that is two inter-event times? Nobody would ever believe the mathematics, and I don't either. So this periodicity of the super eruption simply is not real.
So you're not expecting a super eruption anytime soon?
No, but I have earthquake and ash insurance on my home in Jackson Hole.
Like he says, what's much more likely to happen is either a series of earthquakes, maybe a smaller eruption, a hydrothermal explosion. These are the dangers in Yellowstone.
Rebecca, let me come back to why we are here right now. Obviously, this is an amazing park, and we've been hearing about that, and the national parks are amazing. But this is one of the most iconic places in all of the national park system. Why are we so amazed by geysers?
Because they're incredibly rare and unique. And when people first came into the basin, I mean, they were so curious. First thing they did was take a log and toss it into Old Faithful and start throwing chairs in there to see if they'd come back out. Because they had that
did
same
they?
Curiosity. Yes, they did. In some places in the park, that's not true. I mean, you can't do that. You can destroy hydrothermal features by doing that.
Huh.
But that's what they did because they were curious. And I think our curiosity never dies.
Yellowstone has tremendous amount of background earthquake stresses, volcanic stresses. They're changing all the time. And so the important feature about Yellowstone is it changes all the time. It's a very live system. So I have one closing thought. We've seen pictures of volcanic ash and magma going to the surface, into the atmosphere during the giant eruptions and even the smaller eruptions. So I tell the audience, they should all visit Yellowstone before it visits you.
Which we hope is not anytime soon. Well, Dr. Bob Smith, geologist from the University of Utah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Rebecca Rowland, park ranger here at Yellowstone, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Each year, thousands of deer are killed on roads and highways in New England. Those collisions can lead to costly insurance claims, injuries, and death. Now, a study is exploring what would happen to deer and to humans if an elusive carnivore came back to the Northeast, the mountain lion. Patrick Scahill from Here and Now contributor WNPR in Hartford reports.
Watching Bambi, you'd never think it. But Laura Prue, a wildlife ecologist at the University of Washington, says statistically, deer are the most dangerous mammal in North America to humans.
Everyone's been in a car wreck with a deer out east or knows someone who has.
That includes Prue.
I was a passenger in one when I was a teenager. We were driving to swim practice early in the morning, and I was trying to sleep a little in the back seat, and the driver hit a deer.
Everyone in the car was okay, but each year, Prue says about 200 people die in 1.2 million crashes with deer across the U.S. She estimates those car accidents are enough to cost Americans more than $1.5 billion in damages. Enter the mountain lion.
We wanted to explore what would happen if cougars did return to the eastern U.S.
Right now, all the major wildlife agencies say cougars do not inhabit New England. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says eastern cougars are extinct, and today the only populations that can live and breed on their own are western cougars and Florida panthers. But those cats appear to be wandering further from home. In 2011, a cougar was hit by a car on a highway in Connecticut, and genetic testing revealed that cougar came all the way from South Dakota. Prue and her colleagues say that and other sightings in the Midwestern states raise the future possibility of a permanent population of eastern cougars, and she says can impact deer. To find out how, Prue took lots of deer data, looking at birth rates, population density charts, and car impacts, and paired that up with cougar predation info from the western U.S. Over a 30-year period, she estimated that cougars would reduce eastern deer densities by 22%. Prue says cougars coming back to the region could actually save lives, but Morty Ortega, a wildlife ecologist at the University of Connecticut, is skeptical.
Will it really work? You know, it's very difficult for me to see it here in Connecticut. I probably can see a little bit more, you know, in Maine, for example.
Places where there are more continuous and remote forest landscapes. Ortega says more populated areas could potentially support mountain lions, but forest fragmentation means only a handful could live here at any one time, and they'd have to adapt.
This lion would have to learn how to cross highways, how to move around and about, and they will be moving, you know, within the backyards of a lot of people.
Which Laura Prue says could be pretty scary.
Basically, a cougar is, you know, a 100-pound killing machine that has millions of years of evolutionary history as a specialized predator, you know, an obligate carnivore. And they do specialize on deer, but they will occasionally attack people or pets.
In the U.S. and Canada, over more than a century, cougars have killed 21 people. Still, one Connecticut group is ready to welcome mountain lions. For years, members of Cougars of the Valley have been on the lookout, sharing photos and setting up dozens of camera traps all over the state. So far, they say they've had many false alarms, but no shots yet of the elusive ghost cat. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill in Hartford.
This is Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Yellowstone National Park. And on our way here, we stopped in Montana, which is a state that some analysts believe could be competitive in the presidential race this year. Now, it's only got 3 electoral votes, so it's unlikely to be decisive, but it is a good indication of the changing politics of the West. David Parker is an associate professor of political science at Montana State University. We met up with him at a cafe in Bozeman.
Well, Montana, a lot of people characterize it as a red state, but that's not an apt characterization. It's actually a pretty purple state. It generally goes for Republicans and presidential campaigns, but then down ballot, people tend to vote Democratic.
Right now, Montana has one Democratic senator, John Tester, who was elected in 2006. He's not your typical Democrat, though. He's a farmer, and he's got scars to prove it.
He's missing some fingers on one of his hands, and he's up there on the farm, 10,000-acre farm, putting in peas.
He's also the only senator with a flat-top haircut.
He is the only senator with a flat top haircut, and he still goes to the same barber in Great Falls.
So he's just like a regular guy. He associates with the people of Montana in a way that a national politician of the same party with most of the same views might not.
And I would agree with that. And also, the Democrats here tend to do things that Montana's like. They're skeptical of big things like big business. They're skeptical of big government. They talk about they're generally pro-gun, and they're generally pretty conservative. So those things play well here in Montana.
The state has only gone for the Democrat in presidential elections twice since 1964. The first time for Lyndon Johnson, and the second time for Bill Clinton back in 1992.
So in 1992, it was very close. Bill Clinton just barely won here in Montana, but that was because of the presence of a certain H. Ross Perot.
That made it possible for Clinton to get enough of the vote to win the state, but he didn't need as much as he would if he were just running against one other person.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, Bill Clinton won the state with less than 40% of the vote, and Ross Perot had one of the best showings in 1992. He got about 26% of the vote, which is obviously higher than, I think, he averaged around 19% nationally.
Back in 2008, when President Obama was running for his first term, he lost Montana by just 2 percentage points. It was one of the closest results of any state in the country. This year, Parker says Montana could be fertile territory for Donald Trump. There are few minorities in this state and a lot of whites without a college education, a group Trump is performing well with. Also, in the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders won Montana, so Hillary Clinton has her work cut out for her. Off of Main Street in Bozeman, we met Aaron McCracken, who sells construction equipment. He says he's made up his mind.
Very reluctantly.
Who would that be?
Well, not Hillary, so that leaves me with Trump.
And when you say reluctantly, what makes you reluctant about him?
I don't know that he's mature enough to handle national security, I guess. That makes me leery. He seems like a wild card, and I don't know if that's a public persona or if he's truly like that.
But you still are going to vote for him?
Yes.
So what do you like about him?
I like the fact that he is a wild card, actually. He's outside the political establishment. The fact that the mainstream Republicans aren't behind him is good for me. I want an outlier candidate, I guess. But I think Trump's a little too much of an outlier. But.
And beyond personality, what issues do you like that he is talking about?
I don't know. I guess my vote with Trump is more of a protest vote. I don't particularly agree with his immigration policy. He hasn't gotten specific on the economy. He's just kind of broad strokes, so I'm not sure what I'd rally behind. I don't like or trust Hillary, so.
Aaron's wife, Anna, a nurse practitioner, feels the same way about Hillary Clinton.
I feel like Benghazi and a few of those other, just her cover-ups that, I don't know if that's a media thing that's been portraying those or if they're all true, but I feel like she hasn't been very truthful in her past political standings.
And what's the most important issue to you, would you say?
Probably women's rights, which I know sounds funny that I would vote for Trump in that situation since he's pretty anti-female. But again, I don't trust Hillary.
Jenny Cowan, a librarian in Bozeman, has come to a different conclusion. She will be voting for Hillary Clinton.
I was a Bernie Sanders advocate, and I voted for him in the primary, but I'm going to be just as happy with Hillary, I think. And given the alternatives, I'm 100% for her.
What's the most important issue for you as you vote?
I would say probably only one.
You can name more than one if you want.
I think the environment is probably the biggest issue for me, and I certainly do believe in climate change, and I think there's only some candidates that fall that way too. I also am a pretty big education advocate, so that's another important one for me.
Do you think that Hillary has a chance of winning in Montana?
Well, I do, and I certainly will work for that myself, and I think there are a lot of other people who are working for it, too.
Cameron Price isn't one of them. We found him shopping with his mom.
Absolutely not voting for Trump. Really don't want to vote for Clinton, either. I think I might either write in Sanders or put on Jill Stein, probably.
And what is it that you don't like about both of the major party candidates?
Well, Trump, I'll just try and put it politely, is just not someone I agree with in any sense of the word. And then Clinton just feels like more of the same establishment. I might as well be electing another candidate or something like that. And just not someone I trust in office. I want some actual real change to occur, some definitive economic reform to move the tax burden away from the middle class and to the higher levels. My mom, for instance, makes $30,000 a year, but she still has to pay 10% tax on a sales exchange where she lives in Washington for a car, and that's, I don't think that's something someone making $30,000 a year should have to do. So,
now, Cameron Price mentioned Jill Stein, but according to political scientist David Parker, the third party candidate that could really have an impact in Montana is Libertarian Gary Johnson.
Gary Johnson, I think, is kind of the magic bullet that could actually lead to Hillary Clinton maybe pulling off what Bill Clinton did in 1992, because I think there's going to be a lot more defections on the Republican side. Libertarians do well here in the state. The key is, does Gary Johnson have enough money to get his name out there? And I think if he gets in the debates, that would go a long way to boosting his presence. Libertarians are popular, and that's the thing. A lot of the Republicans here who are libertarian-minded are not fans of Donald Trump.
So far this election cycle, there haven't been any public polls in the state of Montana. And unless one shows a tight race, Parker says, don't expect the candidates to be making stops here. But as the economy here changes and tourism plays a bigger role, Parker expects more new voters to move here from the coasts, changing the state's politics even more, and turning Montana's color on the political map a bit more purple. And to close out this segment, we want to bring you more sounds from Yellowstone National Park, where we are right now. These were recorded by audio archivist Jennifer Jarrett, and you can hear our conversation with her at hereandnow.org. This is the sound of coyotes here at Yellowstone. Might sound familiar even if you don't live near a national park, but listen to this. This is a cougar. Sounds like it's got something important to say. And as we are broadcasting here, at certain times of day, you can see the smoke from the maple fire that's burning in the park. Jennifer Jarrett got the sound of that fire. Here it is. Some of the sounds of Yellowstone National Park as we continue our broadcasts here on the week when the Park Service celebrates its 100th birthday. You're listening to Here and Now.
The price of college textbooks has risen more than 800% over the past 30 years. The Consumer Price Index over that same period, up 250%. Some community colleges are trying to lighten the load by offering zero textbook courses, where the emphasis is on open resources. Linda Williams teaches business administration at Tidewater Community College in Chesapeake, Virginia, and joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So first of all, explain to us what a zero textbook course is. Is it exactly what it sounds like?
It is actually a zero textbook cost degree. In other words, students have access to all of their course content in a digital format, therefore removing the textbook cost and hence the Z degree.
Okay, so they're not paying for textbooks, but are they paying for some of the cost of the digital materials?
No. When Tidewater created the Z degree, one of the criteria was that a student would have full and unfettered access to all course materials on day one of the course at zero cost.
Wow. So how is Tidewater then doing this? Because I presume, are you using materials that still have some form of copyright on them?
Copyright in a sense, in that all of the materials that we use are released under a Creative Commons license, which is an intellectual property license that requires that people be able to reuse, remix, redistribute, and retain those materials for an infinite period of time.
So these are then materials that can be, as you just said, accessed more easily because of the lack of having to pay for them. But I'm wondering, are you concerned that it might lock students out of certain kinds of very important course material? I mean, you teach business administration. Are there case studies, for example, that you'd like to use but can't because you'd have to pay for them?
We would love to have access to more high-quality course materials, but the movement to openness in education and sharing of content is just gaining such momentum that we find that more and more we're able to access open journals, open data, open content at a much higher rate than we have been in the past.
So what has the reaction been from other faculty members? Do they feel like they've had to change how they teach or what they're teaching, or is there enough out there that they're happy with the materials available?
You know, we teach to a set of stated learning outcomes, and so faculty have been extremely successful in finding high-quality, well-aligned content for literally just a host of disciplines, everything from biology to statistics to English to physical education.
And I'm just going to presume that students are happy with this.
They are. They are very happy. Textbook costs are just an astronomical burden, especially for a community college student. Tidewater estimates that we have reduced the cost of an associate's degree by 25% by removing these textbook costs.
Well, Linda, I'm curious. It's all well and good to say that materials are going to be for free, but has it made a difference in the actual outcomes or learning for your students?
It actually has. The data that we've collected since the inception of the project is showing us that students who have access to 100% of their course content on day one succeed at a much higher rate than the students in the non-Z counterparts. We are seeing withdrawal rates in the Z courses that are almost 6% lower than the non-Z counterparts.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of it has to do with access. When students can have access to all of their content on day one, they don't fall behind. And so it really is this idea that regardless of your social, economic, or educational background, you have the same opportunity to succeed starting on day one as everyone else in the class.
Now, as you know, the textbook industry is a big one. The higher ed textbook market nationwide is at least a $7 billion market. Have you been receiving any pushback from publishers?
You know, the publishers have actually started to look at ways that they can engage. We're seeing more and more of them trying to develop platforms where they can actually integrate openly licensed content with their copyrighted content. Of course, that doesn't work for us because we have this bar that we've set that says zero cost. But, you know, I think if institutions are realistic, they know their textbook revenues have been declining for years. Students have been circumventing the bookstore. They rent. They don't buy books. They buy used. So this is the natural result of almost an 812% increase in textbook costs. Eventually, the cost gets so high that people find a way to work around it.
Well, Linda Williams teaches business administration at Tidewater Community College in Chesapeake, Virginia. Really great to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Jeremy, I'm dying to know what it's like in Yellowstone today.
It's a little cold, actually, colder than I would have thought. Our hands are freezing out here. The wind is blowing. It gets down into the 30s at night, but a little warmer as the day goes on. And I'm not complaining, by the way. Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.